Big cities may be losing some of their luster thanks to the coronavirus pandemic.
We don't necessarily want to escape New York City.
During this pandemic, people are leaving LA for more affordable cities and to be closer to family.
But yes, moving on and looking to get somewhere where we can carry on with a more normal lifestyle.
You can go anywhere, right?
People don't need to live in the city.
As some companies are gone for good.
Take that Zoom call in Montana, you can take that Zoom call in Utah, you can take it anywhere.
For months, we've heard about people fleeing cities, and a new NPR Harvard poll out today shows the financial toll the pandemic has taken on America's four largest cities, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Houston. Here in LA, more than half of all households report serious financial problems. Black and Latino communities are disproportionately affected nationwide. We're going to talk about the future of cities now with two people. Joel Kotkin is a professor and fellow in urban futures at Chapman University in Orange. His latest book is called The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class. Hi, Joel.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you. And also joining us is Annalee Newitz. They're a science writer, New York Times contributor, and author of the forthcoming book, Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age. Welcome to you, Annalee.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with you because you are in San Francisco, in a major city that people are fleeing. What does it look like there these days?
Well, today, of course, the sky is dark and orange because we're suffering from wildfires. And on a more typical day during the pandemic, you can definitely see there are fewer people on the streets. There are massive changes in our infrastructure. We have a lot of vacancies where restaurants used to be. And we're really starting to, after all these months, see deep effects from the pandemic shutdown.
Right. I have read that San Francisco, it has a higher vacancy rate than other cities. And is that because there were just more people in Silicon Valley type work situations that can now work remotely elsewhere?
I think that's part of it. I also think that San Francisco has always had a pretty abnormal real estate market where our vacancy rate has occasionally reached close to zero. And so when you see these spikes in availability of houses to buy, for example, or rental prices going down slightly, what that means is that San Francisco is really just having a correction and coming into line with other big cities.
Joel, you have studied cities for most of your career, and I guess I'm wondering what you're reacting to when you hear what Annalee says about San Francisco. Is that what we are seeing nationwide in other cities and other expensive urban centers?
Well, I think, first of all, the important thing is to understand that these trends were existent before the pandemic. Over the last 3-4 years, LA, Chicago, New York all lost population. Migration has been moving A to suburbs, B to some smaller, more affordable cities. So I think we had a trend that was already developing that is now accelerating. Now, the good side, and I think that it's true that there may be a good side in that if rents go down and prices go down, we may see the reinvigoration of cities like San Francisco or New York with younger people, not just people with trust funds. But I think that what you're going to see is you're going to see a new configuration of cities. And that's actually something I'm going to be writing about in the next week or two.
Well, a new configuration in cities or a new configuration of smaller cities becoming more important?
Yeah, I think it'll be several things. One, the core cities, particularly the attractive ones, they will do fine. I think they will become more neighborhood-based. They may become a little less dependent on people commuting in. And I think the big cities will become less important in many ways, but they may become over the long term more pleasant. Then I think you're seeing really rapid growth in a lot of the big Sunbelt cities. You're seeing that the suburbs are going to change. I think they're going to become more places where people, they're not bedroom communities, they're more real places. I think that's happening. And then the really interesting thing from an urban perspective has been the revitalization of small town downtowns that I see: Springfield, Missouri, Fayetteville, Arkansas, Fargo, North Dakota, three examples right off the top of my head.
Well, Annalee, what about this idea that people want to live in the suburbs now more than they did in the past, or that this is accelerating an exodus out of cities because cities had been so unaffordable? What does that do to cities that have basically predicated their growth and their identities on people returning to the cities and living in them and playing in them and working in them and everything?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I agree with Joel that what we're seeing is kind of an acceleration of a trend that was already going on. And a lot of my work focuses on the archaeology of cities, so looking at really the deep history of how cities change over time. And one thing that's important to keep in mind is that we're living in a really unprecedented time when it comes to cities. This is a moment where the majority of the world's population live in cities. And that's very bizarre. It's never happened before. Usually cities have been an aberration. You know, most people lived in villages or towns or in rural areas. And, you know, the people who lived in cities were a tiny percentage of the population. So we're in kind of a massive experiment. And another thing that happens with cities over time is that they do tend to go through phases of abandonment and revitalization. Cities like London, for example, or Istanbul, these are cities that have been around for hundreds of years or thousands of years, and they've gotten really small, they've gotten really big, people have totally rebuilt them. We have to keep that deep history in mind, but we also have to think about in the near future how the abandonment of our cities by basically the ruling class, people who are rich enough to leave, is going to leave behind a deeper split between rich and poor. And so we're going to see parts of cities being revitalized and other parts of cities, I think, will be much more impoverished than we've ever seen before. They'll be abandoned, their infrastructure won't be repaired, they won't have services. So I think we're in for, you know, as Joel said, a tough time.
Well, right. And I'm envisioning, you know, a Latin American city, for example, where you've got really rich people concentrated in these luxury compounds, and then you've got favelas, basically, of poor people. And in Los Angeles, here, you can kind of see that when you drive around, lots of homeless encampments. Is that potentially in our near future or evolving present?
I think that's definitely in our evolving present. Same situation in San Francisco, and I think in a lot of West Coast cities where the weather is good enough that people who are homeless are able to live outside for most of the year. But the other thing is that I want to inject a tiny note of hope here, which is that this kind of massive disaster, the pandemic coupled with the economic collapse that we've seen, this is a time when we have the opportunity to rethink a lot of our social systems in cities and a lot of our social services and how we help the public and how we help people who are homeless and people who need job training and all kinds of other basic needs. And, you know, the last time that we saw a really massive catastrophe like this in the States really was during the Great Depression in the 1930s. And of course, you know, I don't want to compare apples and oranges here. There were obviously many different things going on at that time. But it was a period when we saw the national government and local government stepping up and saying, like, look, it's gotten to be too much. We have to build better social programs to help people who simply have been destroyed by circumstances far beyond their control.
And Joel, part of that would hinge on transportation and good transportation. But it seems, at least in the near future, a lot of people who can choose to might feel unwilling to get on a subway, a train, a bus with other people.
Well, and of course, that trend had been going on for a while. I mean, in other words, you know, the transit has been in most cities, the big exception being New York, has not been really the wave of the future. Let's put it that way. Just to follow up on the point about the New Deal period and even somewhat before, in 1920, Manhattan Island had 2.4 million people. By 1950, and this was partially government policy, developed Brooklyn, developed Queens, developed the suburbs, Manhattan had 1.5 million people, an infinitely nicer city. So, you know, I think we can reinvent our cities, think about them in new ways. I don't think we know exactly where it's going, but we have had the ability to make significant changes. And I agree, you know, that government has to play a positive role and it has to listen to what people want. I mean, this idea that we have here in California that, oh, we're not going to let things develop in the Inland Empire, which is more affordable, a place to live. And we're going to make it, we want everybody to go live in coastal areas that are going to be expensive no matter what. I think there needs to be a real change in how we deal with things. And the social issues, which I totally agree with, part of what we're seeing now, I've been studying this, a lot of the disorders are connected to gentrification. A lot of the anger that exists in these communities, whether it's on the south side of Chicago, the west side of Chicago, East LA, I think we also have to begin to understand, what is the city for? Is a city basically to go in the direction that I think was suggested earlier, where you've got a bunch of rich people who bought their way out of the problems and a bunch of poor people? I don't think that's sustainable over time.
Well, I wonder, when I hear you describe how people might want to live, if this isn't just right here in front of us here in Los Angeles, because you do have the opportunity to have backyard space, so people can enjoy that and not feel like they're going crazy cramped in an apartment. You do have small neighborhoods or small parts of the city that can function as de facto smaller towns. You do have the ability to bike or walk because of the weather. So is Los Angeles situated perfectly to take advantage of this?
Well, LA should be situated perfectly. The problem is that, you know, the move to densify a lot of the neighborhoods have really removed a lot of the positive. And then, of course, schools. I'm speaking as somebody who loves Los Angeles, lived there for 40 years, went through the riots. And yet, over time, congestion was so bad. People were not as nice as they used to be. And it was becoming very, very crowded and uncomfortable. LA has, you know, in many ways, some great, great neighborhoods that would be perfect for this situation. Plus, we have a huge economy of people who can work at home. So we have a lot of positives in LA. And the great genius of Los Angeles was the idea that you could live in a neighborhood, a single family neighborhood in many cases, or a moderately low density area, and still be part of a great city. That was what was so attractive about living in Los Angeles. But between that and, in my case, because I have kids, crappy schools, that was enough to drive us out.
Annalee, what do you think? Do you think LA, I know you've got the San Francisco bias, but do you think LA is positioned to take advantage of this and emerge a better city?
I hope so. I come from Southern California, and my family is all from LA. And so I spent a lot of time there growing up. And I think, you know, LA has as much of a shot as any other city, right? Because one of the things about cities is that they are the sum of their environment, their physical environment, and their political structure. So you're never going to say, have a city that is located or built in a certain way that makes it just perfect for transitioning to a new mode. It has to have good government, and it has to have good management and good social services. So I think, you know, a place like Los Angeles with its sprawl, you know, it could become a city of neighborhoods or a series of cities, which it kind of already is. And I think, unlike Joel, I'm in favor of high density. I mean, one of the issues we have in San Francisco is that we have this sort of artificial low density in several of our neighborhoods because we have a building code which doesn't permit buildings over a certain height. And it's very difficult to kind of change the height of a building once it's been built. And so we have a lot of struggles over that. And, you know, so we're looking at trying to figure out, how do you pack more people into a city but make it livable? And I think the question there becomes, how do you incorporate parkland? How do you incorporate social services into a high density fabric? And we actually do have good public transit in San Francisco, not during the pandemic, but during typical times when people can actually get on a bus and not fear for their lives. So I think public transit is a big part of that too. But I do think that LA and San Francisco and a lot of our other cities, smaller cities as well as big cities, have a chance at a better future
but it's going to require addressing these economic issues and the fact that we're seeing a growing impoverished class. And I just don't think any amount of infrastructure change can address that. We also have to really look at our services.
Emily Newitz is a science writer and New York Times contributor. Joel Kotkin teaches at Chapman University. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
The new plan by the Academy to make Hollywood movies more diverse. We'll get the details next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, after years of Oscars so white, changes are coming to the Academy Awards. Films now need to have more diversity in front of or behind the camera in order to be eligible for the Best Picture Award beginning in 2024. Here with the details is LA Times columnist Glenn Whipp. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Madeline.
All right, there are four categories now for inclusion as Best Picture, and you would have to fulfill two of those four if you wanted to win that award. What are the four categories?
Right. Well, to be nominated, and this is going to happen like 3 years from now, so studios have some time to ramp up, you're going to need some representation either in front of the camera in terms of the actors or perhaps even the themes of the movie. You're going to need representation behind the camera in terms of department heads, say your production designer, costume designer, cinematographer, or you're going to need to have kind of an internship or apprenticeship program in place, which a lot of studios already do. Or, and the fourth one is just kind of audience development, which is basically your marketing, publicity, distribution teams need to be inclusive in terms of women or people of color.
So it seems like the latter two, those, you know, not to be too cynical about it, but they seem a little loophole-y.
The latter two give a lot of room for studios in particular. Indie studios will have a bit harder time, but studios already, their marketing departments, publicity departments are pretty, you know, gender diverse. And in terms of, like I mentioned earlier, internship, apprenticeship programs, a lot of studios already have those in place. So, I haven't, you'd have to do a little digging in terms of last year's Best Picture nominees, but it's possible that all nine of last year's Best Picture nominees still would have qualified under these new guidelines.
So I guess what's getting the most attention is number one, the actors and the themes. And
right.
So what are people saying about that part of it?
I mean, it seems like any time these days when Hollywood movies, studios come out with any kind of thoughts, you know, guidelines to make the world a better place, a more inclusive place, to give people more of a voice, there are people on the far right who are going to say, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket and, you know, this is bad, enough with all the, you know, snowflake type things. But there's a lot of fist shaking anytime this happens, and it's just kind of silly. Because, again, if you look at the wide parameters of these four standards, really, it's just designed to kind of prod studios to include more people, and a big part of that is the internship apprenticeship program, which is like getting people in the door, you know, giving them opportunities to find their way.
How successful has that been in terms of getting people into real jobs from those programs? Often these kinds of programs, people complain about them to say, well, they're pretty dead end. Like, I got the internship and then there was nothing offered after. Is that the case here, or are there really substantial routes out of these internship apprenticeship programs into real jobs?
I think people have reason to be a little cynical, a little questioning about those types of things, because in the past, they have not led to real opportunity. But these days, people are paying much closer attention and to programs that are just kind of, you know, just there to meet some kind of, you know, to make a studio look good. I think people are paying closer attention to what real opportunities come out of them. And when I say there are a lot of groups monitoring Hollywood these days, and studies come out every year, and the numbers are inching up every year. So, I mean, I'm trying to be optimistic about what I can be optimistic about this year. So hopefully this kind of program will reap some benefits down the line.
Right. But those studies that come out, and specifically the one that comes out of USC every year, always seems to point to the fact that it is overwhelmingly white and male in front of and behind the camera. I mean, yeah, Parasite won Best Picture last year, but that seemed to be an outlier.
Yeah. Yeah. The studies that come out are, you know, you see a couple percentage point gains in terms of gender. I think gender has been improving more markedly than people of color.
What about some fears that movies that are worthy, like 1917, for example, because of their subject matter, they were predominantly white and male, those films might not get greenlit?
I think that's ridiculous. I mean, you could look at, I guess, Little Women. You could look at Joker, 1917 last year as films that on the surface would not get greenlit, although I have a hard time believing any kind of world where a superhero movie doesn't get greenlit these days, even one as dark as Joker. But again, these new standards give a pretty wide berth for films to still qualify for Best Picture race, as long as they have, you know, a good internship program, a good apprenticeship program, you know, gender equity in the marketing. But I also think that a lot of these films also would have qualified under the second standard, which was production heads. I guess what it is to say is that there are a lot of ways for films to meet these criteria. And I think you'd have to be doing something really wrong for, you know, to be ineligible for the Best Picture Oscar.
Glenn Whipp is an LA Times columnist who covers the Academy, and we're talking about the new rules to qualify for Best Picture beginning in 2024. Glenn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, two far-right extremists accused of trying to work with Hamas.
They showed up at a Subway restaurant armed with extensive weaponry, including semi-automatic weapons.
The threat of the Boogaloo Boys, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, two members of the far-right group, the Boogaloo Boys, have been arrested and charged with trying to support Hamas. That's the Palestinian political organization and militant group the U.S. considers a terrorist organization. The Justice Department says the two Americans claim to be part of a subgroup of the Boogaloo Boys called the Mujahideen. Officials say in the wake of the protests around George Floyd's death this summer, the two men had plans to carry out violence in Minnesota and that they had a larger goal of overthrowing the U.S. government and replacing its police forces. Here to talk about this is Amy Spitelnik, Executive Director of Integrity First for America. And that's a nonprofit that is suing the organizers of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally for conspiring to commit violence. Welcome back to the program, Amy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And remind us again who the Boogaloo Boys are and what their mission is.
So the Boogaloo movement is probably a much more broad and comprehensive movement than you might think. But at the end of the day, these are essentially anti-government armed extremists who ultimately hope for, through violence and other tactics, a second civil war, oftentimes in direct armed confrontation with law enforcement and other institutions of our government. Within the Boogaloo movement and within the broader far-right extremist movement, there are, of course, a variety of ideologies. Some Boogaloo extremists might identify as white supremacists. Others might not explicitly identify as such. Regardless, it's important to understand how this movement fits into the broader landscape of rising far-right extremism in America, which has sadly been all too clear over the last few months.
How big is this group, and where have we seen them most active in recent months?
It's hard to say how big this movement is. You oftentimes hear about them because they have certainly made themselves known, particularly over the last few months, first during the anti-lockdown protests that were taking place during the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. We saw a number of these armed militias and other extremists, including seemingly Boogaloo extremists, protesting, sometimes with Nazi slogans and imagery. And then, of course, since the Black Lives Matter protests have started, we've seen a skyrocketing number of incidences seemingly involving these Boogaloo extremists. I think many remember earlier in the summer, extremists affiliated with the Boogaloo movement were responsible for ultimately killing two members of law enforcement in California, rather, I believe, killing one and injuring another. Others were arrested for seeking to incite violence at protests in Las Vegas, or as you said earlier, most recently, two Boogaloo boys who sought to coordinate and collaborate with Hamas in attacking American institutions.
So let's talk about that particular case. It involves a young man named Michael Solomon from Minnesota and another young man, Benjamin Teeter of North Carolina. Is it possible that these were just two, you know, disaffected young people with strange fantasies and they weren't really posing any specific threat? Hamas itself says it has no knowledge of them and disavows everything that they stand for, and that they weren't really planning to carry out anything serious. They were just fantasizing.
It's hard to say, but I do think it's important to understand that this is a violent movement and we need to treat it as such. And so that includes assuming threats of violence and other tactics of this movement are legitimate when we see them. We know that, for example, these same two men were tied back to an incident earlier in the summer, or I believe even in the spring in North Carolina, where they showed up at a Subway restaurant armed with extensive weaponry, including semi-automatic weapons and other weapons. And so these are people who seemingly have a track record of terror, of violence. And as we discussed earlier, we know that the broader Boogaloo movement and the broader far-right extremist movement, which includes a number of these militia groups, the white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups, and others, clearly are the biggest domestic terror threat, and frankly, I would say the biggest national security threat facing the United States right now. So whether or not these two specific individuals were ultimately going to, you know, end up collaborating with Hamas and doing something as awful as we could imagine, we know that they are part of a movement that has made clear its capacity for violence and that poses a very grave threat to our communities and to our country.
And how coordinated are these various disparate far-right wing violent groups? Are they individually loosely affiliated, or are they actually making connections?
There is certainly overlap between some of these groups, but I would say that at least at this point, there doesn't appear to be any sort of formal linkage between a number of them. What's interesting, actually, is that Unite the Right, which is the violence that took place in Charlottesville 3 years ago, mm-hmm. was one of the first and broader scale attempts to have a broader moment where these groups came together in a formal way. We know how that ended. We know, as our lawsuit details, that was intended to be a violent weekend. And it culminated in the tragic death of Heather Heyer and extensive injury. So we know that there have been attempts to bring together a number of these white supremacist, neo-Nazi, and militia groups in more formal ways. As of right now, they tend to be a bit more fragmented, which doesn't necessarily mean they're any less dangerous. It's so important to understand that while they might have somewhat different ideologies or goals, they still often use many of the same tools and tactics and share many of the same views, including anti-government views, and in many cases, white supremacist and racist views.
What about this tactic of, which we saw in the Unite the Right rally, of using cars as weapons? That is something that we have seen with extremist groups in other countries. Is this something that has been adopted from jihadist groups?
That's exactly right. Car attacks have become an increasingly deliberate tactic of white supremacists and other far-right extremists. And sadly, I believe NPR reported this earlier in the summer, we've seen dozens and dozens of car attacks just since May when the Black Lives Matter protests started. Oftentimes, just like in Charlottesville, they're fueled and encouraged by these far-right memes, things like the protester digester, which is one of the memes that they pushed around ahead of Charlottesville, or the particularly horrific Black Lives Flatter, which has been making the rounds in some of these far-right forums from the beginning of the summer, where we saw, for example, an avowed KKK leader plow into Black Lives Matter protesters in Richmond, Virginia, just down the road from Charlottesville. He was recently sentenced to 6 years in prison, to many other stints, including just one in New York, a few days ago. These car attacks are clearly a deliberate tactic. And as you mentioned, they are one that seemed to have been cribbed from jihadist terror, much like some of the other parallels that we've seen. You mentioned that the two Buglo boys who were arrested last week were part of the subgroup called the Bujahideen. That's meant to be a play on the word Mujahideen, which is a term that's part of the jihadist terror movement.
So given the threat that these groups pose, how seriously is the Department of Justice taking them?
There has certainly been a change in how the federal government writ large has addressed this, particularly since the El Paso attack, which happened about a year ago. There has been an uptick in arrests and investigations by the FBI and prosecutions by the Department of Justice. But it's important to understand that overall DOJ's focus on domestic civil rights and domestic terror issues like this have dramatically decreased. We know that DOJ civil rights investigations and prosecutions are down nearly two-thirds compared to the end of the Obama administration. And so when you look at something like Charlottesville, it makes a case like the one we're supporting all the more critical, because there isn't action on the federal level in the same way that there might be in prior times. At the same time, you also have DOJ not just treating these civil rights abuses and other far-right threats with the urgency it deserves, but also seeking to deflect by talking about the quote-unquote Antifa terror threat, while all evidence points to the most grave and significant threat facing our country being far-right violent extremism.
Amy Spitelnik is Executive Director of Integrity First for America. Amy, thank you.
Thank you so much.
coming up, how Los Angeles became a global city in a relatively short time period. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, many writers have taken a stab at describing the essence of Los Angeles. There's the snide Dorothy Parker line, 72 suburbs in search of a city. Truman Capote's cheap shot, it is redundant to die in Los Angeles. Also, longer descriptions in books. There's Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep, Walter Mosley's Devil in a Blue Dress, Mike Davis's apocalyptic City of Quartz, and now, adding to the canon, a book by my next guest. Peter Lunenfeld is vice chair of UCLA's Department of Design, Media Arts, and his new book is called City at the Edge of Forever, Los Angeles Reimagined. In it, he attempts to break down the essence of this place into the elements, like an alchemist might. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. All right. So alchemy, which is an ancient practice, combining natural elements with the mystical, and you use this as your framework for exploring Los Angeles. So breaking it down into air, water, fire, earth. Why did you choose this framework?
I really found it extraordinary to try to think about Los Angeles. I moved here in 1988, and it took me 6 months to even figure out if I was going to stay. And then I spent, you know, decades observing, driving around, and trying to fit together all of these disparate elements, you know, the multiple ecologies that we have here, the extraordinary groups of people from all over the world. And, you know, all of it grew up essentially in about 100 years. And, you know, how did something that grows so fast become so influential worldwide? And one of the ways that I started to think about it was through this, you know, proto-science of alchemy. I thought about Earth, and I thought about how the Earth was originally something that the indigenous peoples here had this long connection to, and then that was stolen from them by Spanish priests, and all of that earth was turned into real estate. And real estate remains one of the kind of central issues of Southern California. Then that's followed by fire, which is oil. When you look at downtown Los Angeles, you know, at those teens and 20s buildings, that's oil money solidified into architecture. And then after that comes air. You can look at Southern California's great growth spurt from, you know, the end of the 1930s all the way through the 1990s as this moment of, like, you know, the triumph of the air here. And then pretty much since that date, water's been incredibly important because of the ports. You know, nothing is more invisible to Southern Californians than the combined ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, the largest ports in the Western Hemisphere. And then there's the last thing, this notion of quintessence, right, which is the fifth element, or ether. And that's glamour, and that's Hollywood. And that's the thing that I think still think defines so much of Los Angeles for people who don't live here. And one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book was to, you know, acknowledge the importance of that Hollywood glamour, but also to kind of cut through it. And I think that there's all kinds of figures from the history of Los Angeles who are forgotten by most of us, but remembered very well by some of us. And I wanted to try to create more of those connections between that so that we started to have more of a shared memory, the way that Parisians have a shared memory of their city as a kind of narrative totality.
That's interesting, because so many memories or so many interpretations of Los Angeles are very private. And depending on your perspective, it's almost impossible to have a shared memory because it's so vast. There's so many cultures here. There's so many different histories. And it seems that your book is particularly subjective because you've chosen various anecdotes and various connections to highlight because you found them interesting, not necessarily because they are a shared memory of everyone in Los Angeles, or they should be.
Yeah, I was incredibly fortunate to spend a year at the Huntington Library just doing research. I was on a fellowship there. And one of the things that I dove deep in their collection was aerospace memoirs. And what's so fascinating is that, you know, aerospace was so important to the development of Southern California, but it was a secret world. People, usually men, would go off to plants and offices. And when they came home, they weren't able to talk about what it was that they'd done during the day because it was classified. And I came to realize that the reason we don't have a memory of how important aerospace and, you know, designing jet planes and making rockets, tons of things were built here. The reason is because when you have a secret world like that, by the time you get to the next generation, those stories disappear because those stories weren't even told because they were classified. Hmm. And I think that, you know, that was something that was a real revelation to me.
Let's talk about the origins of JPL and its co-founder, Jack Parsons, whom you were just talking about secrets. He had quite a secretive life that people found out about only after he died. And he was intimately connected with a certain L. Ron Hubbard. Can you talk a little bit about his story and the confluence between science and Scientology?
Yeah, the story of Jack Parsons is going to be told over and over and over again because it's just so fantastic and weird that one of the greatest rocketeers who ever lived also thought that his greatest contribution to humankind was the fact that he was a warlock, that he actually believed in magic, and that, you know, what's fascinating is that he's a kind of untrained scientist. He grew up very rich in Pasadena on Millionaire's Row. And he then went off for his first year at Stanford after having his own private library and becoming really interested in science fiction and especially rocketeering. Well, the Great Depression happens, he has to drop out, and then he's kind of wandering around aimlessly until he starts to meet up with a few people who are students at Caltech, and then they form what they call humorously the Suicide Squad. Why the Suicide Squad? Because they kept blowing things up. Eventually, they go to the Arroyo because it's pretty empty, and also everybody on the Caltech campus is tired of the building shaking when they're blowing things up, and they really start to become the American masters of rocketry. And, you know, one of the interesting things about that chapter is that I make this connection between him and Wernher von Braun, the great German rocket scientist, who is also an actual member of the SS and a member of the Nazi Party, though he was embraced after the war by everybody from Walt Disney to the US government. But there were so many interesting stories about Parsons. As his scientific career started to fade, he actually started this whole interesting mix of occult and science fiction and a little bit of real science, and ends up bringing in a Navy veteran named L. Ron Hubbard. LA in the 30s, 40s, and 50s is a hotbed of real science, but also of science fiction. And most people don't know that the first text of Scientology or pre-Scientology, Dianetics, is actually serialized in science fiction magazines.
Well, all of this is tied up in the cinematic as well, and how Los Angeles has sold itself, views itself, and how people outside Los Angeles see it on screen, in books, and just in art in general. Is it your contention that all of this could not have happened in any other place but Los Angeles?
Yeah, I'd say the stories I'm telling are very specific to this city. I talk about, you know, this is a place that people are willing to reimagine and reinvent themselves. And I think that that's something that is really in the DNA of this city now. And, you know, in these particularly vicious times, I hope that that DNA helps to sustain us.
So LA is also a place where a lot of dark things have happened, a lot of racial strife, a lot of, which you write about in the book, a lot of police brutality against minority communities, and how that has been etched into the very soul of Los Angeles. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, where this whole idea of itself as the city of tomorrow, you call it the city on the edge of forever, comes butting up against the harsh reality of the present, which can be pretty dark for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that LA does have a dark history, but I also feel that one of the great things about being in LA right now and writing the history of LA is to write in a way that acknowledges what makes a city interesting, fascinating, and worth living in, at the same time as you acknowledge the deep human and cultural costs that this has been taken on, you know, indigenous populations, on all kinds of populations of people and individuals, and that, you know, you can use that as a way to build a juster 21st century Los Angeles than the explosive and often quite unjust Los Angeles of the 20th century.
One potent symbol that you talk about is the Corvette Stingray, and how that on the one hand symbolizes the bright, shiny, literally shiny future of America, right? The automobile, going fast, sports car, freedom, top down. But it was designed by a Japanese American who was interned at Manzanar.
Yeah, that was another one of those kind of like incredible discoveries. I was lucky enough to spend almost 15 years teaching at Art Center College of Design before I moved over to UCLA. And, you know, that's the hotbed of automotive design. And even though I'd been there for, you know, a long time and kind of went pretty deep into thinking about car design, I never made this connection with Larry Shinoda, a guy who went there for 1 year and then was pretty much hired away by Detroit because he was so incredibly talented. And then the deeper I got into the story of Larry Shinoda, who, because he's Japanese American, because he's growing up in Los Angeles, he and his family end up in Manzanar. And for me, it was so poignant. He creates this icon of the American dream at the level of apple pie and Elvis, yet he does it with this deep knowledge of what's wrong with this country and a kind of suffering that, you know, I wish I could say is unimaginable today. But again, I tried to juxtapose these really important things about our past with things that I hope will bring a certain amount of delight. There's a little history of the cup holder, also invented here in Los Angeles. So,
and the 99-cent store, which I didn't know.
Yeah, gotta love the 99-cent store. Yeah.
And, invented here by a guy who worked at Grand Central Market and realized that 99 cents was the sweet spot for selling stuff.
Yep. 98 cents didn't work. $1.01 didn't work, but 99 cents worked like a dream. And he was just one of those incredibly hardworking entrepreneurs of this city who remade the shape of it. And, you know, what I think is so interesting about what Dave Gold did in that store was he looked at what he was doing and not as kind of like getting rid of junk that nobody wanted. He looked at his daily job as curation. And, you know, so when you go into a 99 cent store, it has a different look and feel than other discount stores. And I think that that's exactly what, you know, attracted artists to who've been interested in the 99 cent store. And, you know, one of the most expensive photographs in the history of photography is actually of a 99 cent store, just with all the colors amped up.
Well, it does say everything about Los Angeles, right? The cheap and the expensive, the flash, the invention, the optimism. It just kind of encapsulates a lot of Los Angeles, that anecdote.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there is still something about Los Angeles where, you know, you never know who you're encountering. You never know what their background is. You never know. And I think that, you know, in a way, there's something a little bit more egalitarian about the way that that Los Angeles functions. And it's something that really has attracted me, again, over the decades. It's one of the reasons I haven't left.
Peter Lunenfeld, his new book is called City at the Edge of Forever, Los Angeles Reimagined. Peter, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Madeline.
That is our show today. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Podcast and listen whenever and wherever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.